Naomi, good morning.
Good morning, Neil.
Thank you so much for taking the call. I've read your story. You've been through an horrific ordeal. You're trying to put your life back together again in spite of what this monster did to you. Can you talk us through the story and how you ended up telling this tale today?
Okay, well, I was raped on September 1st, and so I had to go to Dublin because my dad had died, and I was on my way to my dad's funeral. I ran into some problems with my passport
You were trying to
because
get
I,
back to Canada, weren't you?
yeah, I was trying to get back to Canada to for my dad's funeral. And my Canadian passport was expired, so I was trying to fly on my UK passport and ran into some difficulties, so I had to go to the embassy. So I booked an airport hotel by the Dublin airport. And then I got onto the emergency line in Canada at the embassy in Ottawa, and they sent me a form, but I wasn't sure until the next morning if I would have clearance to fly. So that night, I didn't know if I would be able to even get home from my dad's funeral. So it's just a really difficult time. And so
Had he died on it?
I
Had he
was.
died unexpectedly? That must have come as a terrible shock in itself.
He did, yeah. And my grandma had died 10 days earlier, but she was older. She had lived a long life. And then my dad, he was 79, so. He's still young today, isn't it? And
Yes.
he died in his sleep, so he had no pain or anything, but it was a surprise, and none of us were really expecting
And
it.
where were you living at the time? Was it Cork or Dublin or the UK or where?
Oh yeah, I live in Cork, so I live
Okay.
in Douglas.
So
Yeah.
there are a number of hotels near to the airport. You choose to stay in one overnight so you could get this cleared up in the morning and then fly to Pearson and be there for your dad's funeral.
So I went to the hotel and I got onto the embassy, and so I got it sorted, but I didn't know that I had it sorted until the next day. So that night, I at that point, it felt like I was at the lowest point in my life. I was just so sad about my dad. I had been crying for 3 days straight since I heard the news, and so I was just a long, stressful day. So I went down to the hotel bar to get a glass of wine, and I was sitting there, and then this man came up and he sat beside me. He was like a clean cut man, seemed like a just a businessman, a gentleman. He started chatting to me, and so he told me that he's an engineer and he's going to the States for work. And I told him about my dad dying and that I was trying to get home to the funeral and I wasn't sure if I'd be able to make it. So we chatted for a bit, and then he just kind of came across like a gentleman. He was really clean cut and
You're just having
nice.
a
And
conversation with another fellow traveler, somebody else who's going to be catching a plane the next morning. You do these things. Yeah, I know.
that's it, exactly. And he wasn't flirty or forward or anything. Like there was no none of that vibe. But he offered to buy me a drink, so I accepted. And then I don't remember anything else from that moment on until I woke up the next morning.
Do you remember taking some? Do you remember drinking that drink he bought you or anything?
I do remember starting to drink. Like I remember getting the drink in my hand. I don't know if I remember actually drinking it or not. It's all just kind of hazy now. I'm not sure.
Oh my God. And the next thing you remember was the next morning?
So the next morning, I woke up in my hotel room and I was on the single bed. And I still remember, like, the horror of the moment still haunts me when I opened my eyes, because he was on the double bed in my hotel room and he was just watching me. And I don't know, that moment, I don't know, it just still, like, I still get just horrors from it. But anyway, so then he raped me again and then he left. And I was still sort of hazy from the drugs, I think. Like I didn't even realize what happened. I was just sort of kind of like, and then so I went and I had, but my body was in pain, and I went and I had a shower, and I saw I had bruises all over my legs, and then I later discovered I had like two burn marks. They looked like cigarette burns, just small burns on my arm, and my ring was gone. And I know that sounds like such a silly thing. It was costume jewelry. It wasn't worth anything, but I wore it all the time, and it just felt so personal that he
Doesn't
took
sound it
something.
doesn't sound silly at all, actually. That's another invasion of your body and your life.
I felt like he stole something of me, even beyond what he stole from me every other way,
Yeah, there were two almost emptied glasses of Prosecco, and you remember those glasses in vivid detail, don't you?
I do. So they were sitting there on the dresser and they were almost empty, and one had a strawberry and one didn't. And I think it was when I saw that that I started to connect the dots of what happened, and that he
He
had drugged
drugged the
me.
drink that he bought you when he went up to the bar to buy it.
Exactly.
And when you woke up feeling awful, absolutely awful and in pain, Did he say anything besides smirking over at you and then raping you again? Did he ever speak?
No.
Did you cry out or anything? No.
I said, you know, I remember in the morning, I was still in a haze, but I just remember I kept saying, stop, I just woke up, stop, I just woke up, which, I don't know, I think that you think that you'll react in a different way, and maybe you think you'll scream or whatever, but I was just in a haze, and I think I was just not even fully awake, just not quite there, do you know?
And then he left?
Yeah, then he left, he got dressed and left.
Oh my God, what did you do? You
do you know what? I
went
was
into
so
autopilot,
attacked.
I think, did you?
I did. I was still not sure if I was going to my dad's funeral yet. And so I checked my emails and I saw that I got the clearance to fly. So I was happy about that. I just went, I was so detached. I can't even explain it, but I just sort of went and I switched modes and I was like in the mode to go to my dad's funeral. And it was like, it was really strange because I was able to go home and I was able to be focused on my family and focused on my dad's funeral and grieving him. And it was like, I was completely emotionally separated from what had happened. But like in my mind, when I was by myself, when I was in Canada, I was Googling things and I went to the pharmacy and I got a morning after pill. And so my mind was still kind of racing and aware and looking for some sort of explanation, I guess. But my emotions were completely, I didn't have any, you know, I was
Did anybody or any of the family pick up on any of this, I wonder?
I don't think so. I think everybody was upset about my dad anyway. And so everybody was sort of emotional. Nobody seemed to, I don't even think I did act different. I think I was just so emotionally separated and I just sort of switched zones into right now I'm focusing on my dad.
Yes, and
family,
I think that was a very brave thing of you to do, actually, to park your own turmoil, because you knew that there was a grieving process by all of your family going through with the death of your father. I think that was a brave thing to do. You may not have known that's what you're doing, but it was one element.
I think it was like my unconscious, my subconscious mind kicking in or something, because I probably couldn't have handled it all at the same time.
My God, that must have been an awful, awful time for you. And the flight back all on your own then, after burying your dad. What did you do? Did you continue to block it out for a period of time or what?
Yeah, so, you know, I came back and with work, we were scheduled to go to the British Hairdressing Awards over in the UK the next day. So I just came. I was just sort of in business mode, like just autopilot carrying on. And so I went to work and we were kind of like sponsoring an award. So I kind of did my bit there. And then I came back and I worked for a few weeks. And I think in those weeks, I was still very emotionally detached. My mind wasn't able to concentrate as much. I wasn't able to handle as much as I was used to handling. So I noticed my work start to suffer, but I still just felt like, I don't know, I was just still just going on.
But what about maybe sexually transmitted diseases? Did that pass through your head in the early days at all?
So the first, I guess, like it was sort of in my head, but I don't know. I was just sort of, I think I just sort of blocked it out for the first few weeks, even though it was racing in my mind. And then I was driving to work one day and I drove past the Rape Crisis Center. And it was really when I saw their center that I had the thought, I should really get tested for STDs. And so I called them and I don't actually remember that particular phone call, but I remember that I hung up and I just burst into tears. And I don't know, I felt like, I think everything sort of started to hit me since then. I went and I talked to them and Mary, she was absolutely fantastic. You know, she really just took me, you know, like as a mom, you know, like she was just so
Mary
empathetic.
And this was the first person Crowley that you had an opportunity to tell your horror story. You hadn't turned and shared it with friends.
No, not at that point.
It must have been a very lonely time for you. Were you managing to sleep? I think you mentioned that you had very vivid nightmares for a long, long time.
Yeah, for the last 6 months, really, I still have horrible nightmares. Like I just don't sleep without a sleeping pill, and I have horrible, horrible nightmares. And it's like the dreams are so real that when I wake up, I can't even decipher if it's actually happened or if it's a dream. I sort of have to center myself and realize, okay, this is a dream.
And do the dreams take you back to the attack again, and to his face, and to him looking over, smirking at you?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I wake up like just crying sometimes, and I just wake up sometimes just like screaming, like I'm caught in this dream and I'm like screaming out. It's just been horrendous. And flashbacks. And my whole personality changed, Neil, in the last 6 months. And I feel like now I'm finally starting to get back to myself. But
yeah, your personality changed because you were zombie-like, you know, living in this shell of a body that you no longer recognized or even probably wanted to be in for something that wasn't your fault. But would you have been an outgoing kind of a person before all of this?
Yeah, exactly. Like my personality, normally I'm very outgoing. Like I love people, and even like silly little things. Like I love to always have my eyelashes done and my nails done and dress cute. And the last 6 months, I just became a complete hermit. I withdrew from my friends. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I haven't worn makeup in 6 months, except for like, I can count them on one hand. I've just been in my sweats. You know, I didn't care. And I didn't even recognize this version of myself. I sort of lost all my interests, all my passions, like everything that is me, that I identify with being me, was just sort of gone. And it was like my personality and soul were taken, and I was left with this shell of a body. And I've just been so desperate to try to get back to myself and just not really knowing how.
Is the subconscious aspect of you not getting your nails done, not getting your hair done, wearing tracksuit pants, not wearing makeup, is it a way of trying to anonymize yourself from people, do you think, and particularly to make you invisible or unattractive to stranger danger and men?
Yeah, that's it exactly. Like, you know, because if I go out and if I have to go buy food or whatever, and I'm wearing my tracksuit and have no makeup, nobody looks at you. You know, you kind of just feel like you're invisible. And I feel like that was definitely a big part of it.
Does it make you feel
just wanting to
safe.
Disappear?
Yeah. And when you when you spoke to Mary Crilly, did she tell you that these emotions that you were feeling, these nightmares, this sense of awfulness and depression, was perfectly normal? This was the emotional roller coaster that you would be on.
Yeah, she did, and they were fantastic. And I went after I went to the Rape Crisis Center. I also spoke to my doctor, and so I've been seeing other therapists. And you know, everybody's sort of been normalizing my feelings. But you know, the one thing that everybody has been saying to me, and I feel like it's probably something a lot of other rape victims might deal with as well, is that when you're going through something like this and you don't know who you are anymore, you're trying so hard to get back. And almost like everybody I've spoken to that's a professional has said, you need to stop trying so hard and just sort of accept and grieve, you know, because this is part of the process.
Yes.
And I think like my therapist one time, he said, you know, he's like, what you're doing is you've got this like ball and you're like trying to throw it and it just keeps on coming back. But he's like, you've got to just like ease into it and relax and accept it. And then your hand will open and drop the ball away from you. And then it's gone, you know,
at some stage. Yeah. Yeah. And Naomi, at what stage in this process of the last 6 or 7 months, at what stage did you decide that it was time to talk to the Gardaí?
So I went to the guards probably just probably within 2 weeks of coming back from my dad's funeral. It was within a week or two from getting back from Canada. It was after I spoke with Mary Crilly, that I went to the guards. And so I went to the guards and I went with the intention of making a report. And the guard I spoke with, she was super nice, but she advised me not to actually make a report. She said that the system is just hell. She said that you'll basically be 2 years. She said, because I don't have forensic evidence, because I was away for the funeral and I didn't report it in time.
Well, the forensic evidence you're talking about is upon your own body, which would be
DNA
and things. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
Okay. But there would have been CCTV of you with him in the bar, him bringing you from the bar, probably helping you from the bar, putting you in a lift and everything. In all fairness, come on.
Yeah, she did say that. She said they would have the CCTV footage in the window that I had gone to her. But she said even with the CCTV footage that the chances were that I'd be dragged through 2 years of hell just retelling my story, revisiting the rape site, and that the chances were high that he would walk free.
Someone she knew had been through something like this, and she was retelling you their story of how the person that she knew, her rapist, walked free.
Yeah, exactly. And that person had forensic evidence and all of the proof that they needed, but the rapist still walked free. And that person was dragged through just 2 years of hell that they said was more traumatic.
And he walked away. He walked away unconvicted. And it was it was her contention that the same would happen to you.
Exactly.
And do you think that she was right?
I do. Do you know? I mean, obviously, I've never had to deal with this in the system before, but just based on the stories that I've heard, that's That's how it appears to be.
That she was being compassionate woman to woman.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. No, it was definitely that sort of vibe that she was looking out for me. And she did say that, you know, there's no statute of limitations on rape. So she said, you know, right now, at the time I went to her, I was in a really, really low place. And she said, get yourself stronger. If you still want to make a report, you can come back and I'll do it for you. But she said, really, the process is just hellish.
But what, was it not even possible for the Gardaí to investigate it? To
no,
but hang on a second. To go to the hotel, get the CCTV footage, find out if the guy stayed in the hotel, get his name and address, visit him, question him, put the fear of God into him, because there's a chance that this guy planned that and could have done it numerous times.
I have a feeling that he is a serial rapist. That's my gut feeling. And the guard said the same, but she said that that wasn't possible unless I get a formal report. Because I was saying, you know, I don't think that I'm a one-off victim of his. And so I was like, what if somebody else comes with a story that's very similar to mine, you know, that has the same MO? Could you just sort of like make a note that this happened? And but she said, no, it has to be a formal report and go through the whole system and process.
That formal report would have, you mean you making a statement?
Yeah, like making it so it's a formal report. Like, 'cause I went to make a statement. I told her everything, but she didn't actually file it as a report against
So this guy didn't even get scared. He didn't get a warning. He didn't get the wind up him by the cops coming around saying we're investigating an allegation. Even though the guys would have known, they wouldn't have been able to get a conviction. At least it might have frightened him into stopping.
Exactly.
That's what I think, you know. That's just what I think.
I do too. I feel the same. And it makes you angry that, you know, it's so easy to get a parking ticket or a speeding ticket, or people can go to jail if they don't have their TV license paid. But then there's actual criminals and it's so difficult to get them convicted.
I think there's a stat, and I'm open to correction on air of this, that only 8% of women who are raped actually report it. And of those 8%, something like between 2 and 4 results in an actual criminal conviction. That's tiny.
It's ridiculous, isn't it? I know. And I posted recently just publicly about my story. And I've had so many women that have contacted me telling me the same, that they've been sexually assaulted, they've been raped, and none of them talk. And like, none of them have reported, bar one, whose mother reported when she was a minor. But none of them have reported. There's like this fear of the system and of the guy just walking free. And I think there's a lot of shame, you know, and I feel like I'd really like to break that stigma of shame, because if somebody breaks into your house or if somebody like mugs somebody on the street, you know, people talk about it. It sort of makes us safer because it's talked about, because, you know,
well,
you
are so right. But there have been a number of high profile rape cases in the Irish judicial system where the women who have been, or at least are alleging, I have to say, alleging that they were raped, they're almost held up as being the perpetrator, the questions that
are
asked. They almost feel as if, like, what were you wearing? You remember the reference to a thong there in a case there recently?
Yes.
And then, it's almost like you were asking for it. Do you know?
Exactly.
That's why women are slow. That's why women are slow.
I agree.
But did you say that many women feel that they believe it was that they believe it was their own fault?
Absolutely. I feel like you definitely do. You put the blame on yourself. I feel like for me, one of my biggest questions with this happening is because, you know, I said before, I like to dress cute and have my makeup done. But that night I had been crying for 3 days straight. I was traveling. I looked horrendous, you know, and I kept on questioning why. Like, you know, sounds so stupid, but I kind of felt like if I looked cute, maybe I could understand it, but I looked horrible.
Well,
you know?
I think he saw that. He saw the vulnerability of you, and they have a sixth sense. Perpetrators like that, they play up on that. They see you in a vulnerable state. They know that you're there for the taking because you are vulnerable, you're crying, you're upset, and it makes you easy prey. This was not your fault.
Yeah, no.
It just was not your fault. Incidentally, do you feel uneasy around men now? Do you trust men? Are you scared around strangers?
It's funny. Like I said, I've been such a hermit the last 6 months, but I have noticed a few different times. Like, I remember one time I was just walking on the street and this man came up behind me and I just went into absolute panic, you know, and like the poor guy, he was just crossing the street. He wasn't doing anything, but I have noticed I'm much more on guard, you know, and I feel like also there's a fear because, you know, the guy who talked to me, he didn't look, you know, this sounds so crazy, but he didn't look like a rapist. Like, he didn't look like I should be scared of him. He just looked like a gentleman, a businessman, yeah. like a nice guy, you know. So
isn't that frightening? Isn't that frightening
yes,
that he didn't look like, as we say, a
part.
Monster? Isn't that frightening?
That's it. Exactly. And I think that is the terrifying part of, you know, who can you trust and how do you know what is okay and what's safe and what isn't, you know?
Have you good friends surrounding you now? Have you shared with them? Did you eventually tell your family?
I have good friends. I have two particularly good friends here in Cork that have really stood with me, and they've been absolutely amazing. I've sort of withdrawn from my wider circle of friends just in the last few months, but I do have close friends who've really been absolutely amazing, and I don't think I'd have been able to make it through without them, to be fair.
And family at home in Canada?
Yeah, do you know what? I haven't actually talked to my family much because everybody's still grieving my dad,
know,
and there's just so much stuff going on.
Yeah, you really are being very kind to your family while carrying all of this struggle and emotion. Are you back at work?
I haven't, no.
Oh.
I had to take a leave of absence, and so, I wasn't functioning.
Yeah, you're still struggling, aren't you?
In the last few weeks, I'm doing better, but the last 6 months have been absolute hell. I feel like, you know, once this whole virus passes, I'll be in a stronger position.
I hope so. I really do.
Yeah.
I hope so. I hope there are much better times ahead for you. And by talking to me, do you hope that this will make a difference for women who have been through exactly the horrors that you've been through?
I just want women to be able to have a voice and not feel like we need to be silenced. And I want to help to break the stigma. You know, it has nothing to do with, like you said earlier, there's nothing to do with what a person looks like, what they wear. There's no certain like age or type or demographic. You know, like there's no action that any woman can take. And I just want to break that stigma and the shame, because there's so much shame associated with it. And I just wish that would break so that women could talk freely about it, because it is traumatizing, and adding to the trauma of that is the silence, you know, and not feeling like you can speak and be heard.
I know. Well, you know, I don't know whether all of your bruising has healed or whether those cigarette burns have healed. I hope they will, and that emotionally you'll get stronger in the coming weeks and months ahead, and you'll be able to get on with what would be a very long and happy life, because, you know,
thank you.
There are many people listening, me included. You know, it could be anybody's partner. It could be, oh my God forbid, it could be anybody's daughter, you know?
Yeah. No, it's true.
Naomi, look after yourself, and thank you so much for having the courage to talk. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Neil. Thank you.
Have a good day.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.